Hello, everyone. This is Mireille Gino, and you are listening to the New Books in African American Studies podcast. Joining me today is Professor Sonia D. Williams, currently professor in the Department of Media, Journalism, and Film at Howard University, and the winner of 3 George Foster Peabody Awards as a radio producer. She's also the author of Word Warrior, Richard Durham, Radio and Freedom, published by the University of Illinois Press, and the book we'll be discussing today. Professor Williams, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. It's great to finally talk to you. That's kind of an inside joke for the listeners. It's been an interesting process to get to this point. But I wonder if you'd begin by telling us a bit about yourself.
Okay. No problem. I was born and raised in New York City, in the Bronx specifically, but it was a great place to grow up. And my parents were really, they made sure that my brother and I took advantage of everything that New York City in its craziness and fullness had to offer. And that included both everything on the educational side and taking advantage of New York's public and private school system, as well as artistically. From the time that I was a child, music was quickly identified as my first love. anytime there was an instrument around, a little baby ukulele, a guitar, something like a blow-in, that's what I was doing. So music was my entree into the artistic world, but also both my mother and father are readers. So they made sure that we read and fell in love with books and eventually also fell in love with writing. So that's kind of the early background. And I really kind of came to this project and to my career through radio, but I got to radio through music. So it all kind of meshed together.
Well, the book obviously takes as its subject Richard Durham, who was known, I think, best for drama and dramatization. And I wonder if you'd start by sort of telling us that maybe you might, I guess, speculate why you think he's not better known.
I think that there's a lot of reasons. For one thing, as a personality, he was not the kind of man to really go out and self-promote. If you walked into a room and he was in the room, he wouldn't be the hail fellow well met. He wouldn't be the glad-handed kind of guy. He's really relatively soft-spoken and fairly quiet, particularly in instances or cases where he didn't know the people in the room. But once he got into a discussion and or the discussion was really something close to his heart and it involved debate and talk and, you know, really kind of interchange, then he would, you know, really come out of, I wouldn't say out of his shell, but he would be more loquacious. But in terms of why he isn't more well-known, I guess the speculation is, one, that he was a bit radical for his time, and so therefore he would not have necessarily have been in the mainstream. He also relished being in the shadows and exerting influence from behind the scenes. So he was not someone, even as a writer, who would have really pushed his work out there and self-promoted. And then number three, his friends all felt that because his major, well, I won't say major, one of his early claims to fame was radio, and radio is rather ethereal, even if it's drama. Of course, it's very ethereal if you're a DJ or if you're an announcer on a talk show, and you have, whether it's a daily program or weekly or whatever, you are on the air, you say what you have to say, or you're interviewing folks, and unless it's recorded and the recordings are played over and over again, it's not necessarily going to last. And so I think because radio initially was his claim to fame and he was good at it, but it was also the time when, radio, you heard it or you didn't. And even though there are transcriptions of some early radio programs from, say, the 40s and maybe the 30s. It's not like today where you can go to your computer or your cell phone and, you know, go to a particular website and hit a button, and there you can hear your favorite feature or radio show or interview over and over again, or as many times as you want. So I think that's it. And then later on in life, when he branched out from radio and got into both television, was in print media, he, you know, worked on an autobiography, and he ghost wrote a couple of books, and he also got into the political sphere. I think that, again, he was a behind the scenes powerhouse. He was not someone who either self-promoted or wanted to be promoted, and so I think that's why he's not more well-known.
That makes a lot of sense, and you've touched upon a number of things that that we'll get to. The first two chapters are sort of devoted to covering the early part of his life, and he and his family were part of the Great Migration. The family, if I'm remembering correctly, he was born in 1917. And the family moved in the 20s to Chicago from Raymond, Mississippi, parents wanted to move to improve their children's educational prospects.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of a familiar, pretty familiar narrative in terms of the North representing freedom and that sort of thing. In your third chapter, which I think holds really important insights into Durham's understanding of himself and this sort of very interesting, deliberate self-fashioning, he goes through a couple of things. You mentioned already that his interest, obviously, in radio. But in this chapter, in the third chapter, you sort of detail, you know, how he tries his hand at boxing. He tries his hand at poetry. He changes his name a couple of times. And I wonder if you'd sort of talk a bit about that, this personal evolution.
Yeah, it was really fascinating finding out about his early life because, again, I came to Richard Durham because of my interest in and my work as a documentary producer in radio. So in finding out about his background, his family clearly followed the pattern that many African-Americans who were born and raised in the South, either they were or their parents were or grandparents were former slaves. And of course, as soon as slavery ended and we moved into the 20th century, education and increased employment opportunities was key. The key thing about his family was that they had an advantage over what happened with several other African-American families that moved from the South to the North. And that is, Durham's father owned their land. They had 80 acres of farmland in Raymond, Mississippi. So interestingly enough, and I talk about it in the book, they owned that land. And when they moved to Chicago, they did have some savings, more money than, say, you know, some of their colleagues who had also done the same northern migration. So Durham was all of five when he arrived in Chicago with his mother, father, and six brothers and sisters. But as he grew into a teenager, he was a really curious and really mischievous kind of boy. And one of the things that happened that helped to kind of set his path in life, I think, was that when he was in his early teens, maybe 12, 13, somewhere in there, he started having trouble with his left leg. And his parents just thought, oh, you know, it's growing pains. It'll go away. But it didn't. And it persisted. And it really bothered him. And they finally took him to a doctor. And it was diagnosed as this chronic condition that he had to wear a cast. And so he was restricted. Here's a boy who was really active out in the world, running around, doing his thing. And now he's got this cast on that they say might have to stay on for, if not months, then maybe a year. And so he's restricted more or less to the house. And so while he's home, he gets into really reading, and he reads a variety of literature, poetry, drama, fiction, you name it. And his father and his mother were both readers, and they loved the word. And so I'm sure that he was influenced by that environment. And also he listened to the radio. So he's listening to what's going on Chicago radio, the dramas, the comedies, the music shows. And he also realizes by the time 1929 happens that, you know, that the few representations of African Americans on radio was pretty skewed to a negative stereotype. And we're talking about Amos and Andy, which was the most popular show, not only in Chicago, but eventually when it became national in 1929 in the country. So he's listened to that and Beulah, which, by the way, when Beulah first came on, was voiced by a white actor. So you have this white man playing a black maid. And really kind of crazy. So anyway, he's listening to this, and I'm sure he start his consciousness like, wait a minute, I know a lot of people in my family, the folks in his neighborhood, who are not like the Beulahs of the world or the Amos and Andys. And that helped to really kind of form his consciousness. In addition, with his love of reading and reading a little bit of everything, he said several times that one of his influences was Richard Wright, another transplanted Mississippian who had moved to Chicago. He was older than Durham, but he moved there and, you know, started writing and doing that. And so Richard Wright had formed or helped to form the Southside Writers Group, which was a group of some budding and some established writers, black writers. And their whole thing was to support each other in their writing journey. But Richard Wright was also in the Communist Party, and his philosophy was that black writers needed to think about and utilize, say, some of the philosophies of Marxism, but also infused with the whole idea of what's happening in urban America. So, yes, we can take something from, you know, communist or Marxist philosophy and also infuse it with the traditions of European writers, but also of African-American writers. So I really think that he was influenced by that, along with the writing that he gravitated towards and kind of consumed, which included the writings of W.E.B. Du Bois. He was a Du Boisian. He loved Du Bois's analysis and writing. So he got into Du Bois. He was also a great fan of Langston Hughes and eventually became a friend of a lifelong friend with Langston. And also the other person who he saw as one of his literary mentors was Charles Dickens. And that's because in reading Charles Dickens' work, he felt that he was a master storyteller. He could get the reader to get into his world and with characters that were really compelling and interesting and could hold your attention just by the way he presented those characters. So I think that his earlier years, once he became a teen and then started really reading and listening and absorbing these ideas from these various other masters, writing masters, that helped to form who he became.
Right. And, in 39, he secures employment with the Illinois Writers Project, which is a WPA sort of FDR's relief program. And I wonder, this also kind of finally opens the way to radio as well. And this you detail in your fourth chapter. And I wonder, this is also a really pivotal moment in his life. And I wonder if you would sort of talk about that in his entree into radio.
Yeah. He actually got into the Illinois Writers Project, which was a program of the WPA, because of poetry. He, in 1937, 36, somewhere in there, 38, he was writing poetry. He really loved poetry, which is, I think, one of the reasons why he was drawn to Langston Hughes. And so he started writing. He got into a writing a group. And one of the requirements for the WPA Writers Program, the Illinois Writers Program anyway, was that you had to have published pieces. And because he had written so many poems, he had sent some of them to various publications. So he was fortunate enough to get his work published in the Chicago Defender and the Pittsburgh Courier and in the New Masses magazine and a few other magazines. So he had a nice little cache of published work. And so when he applied to the Illinois Writers Project, that requirement he met. He also met the requirement that you had to know how to type, and he was an excellent typist. And so he applied, he was admitted, and he comes into this world that is really pretty unique. Illinois, Chicago, New York, New York City, California, San Francisco, and I believe even L.A. had some really major talent who were working as part of the WPA Writers Program, and that in Illinois, you had people like Saul Bellow and Nelson Algren and Jack Conroy and Arna Bontemps and Margaret Walker, Catherine Dunham, who were all working as writers in that writer's project. So he comes into this and he's writing for the project. Essentially, he's critiquing some of the articles that are in different periodicals. And then one day he looks over and he sees this group of people who are sitting around this large conference table, about 20 men and women. And he's like, what is going on over there? Because they were animated, they were laughing, they were arguing, they were really into their work. And he goes over and he finds out that this is the Illinois Writers Project's radio division. And these are men and women who are writing radio scripts for local programs, and they're writing dramas, usually 15 minutes, and they're original based on whatever the program was. But they're writing these pieces, and then maybe a week or two later, they're actually produced on air. So he gets involved with this writing division, the radio division, and he's also there with Studs Terkel, another black writer named Robert Lucas and several others, and it's like love at first sight. You know, he really gets into it, and Arna Bontemps, who was his supervisor, said that, you know, this was it for him. Both him and Robert Lucas just kind of took to it. And that's how he got into writing scripts for radio. I do say in the book that Richard's first scripts were really pretty bad. they were way too long, or at least loquacious. There was very little action. He had a bunch of characters. And because it's radio, you don't see these folks. It's different if you're writing for television. You can write characters and they flow into this or onto the screen and flow off. In radio, you only have the voice and, of course, sound effects and music. And you have to make sure that people understand who is talking and who they're talking to, and there's a clear distinction between characters. So, but the great thing about this division was that they met every week and they critiqued each other's work. And if nothing else, Durham was a quick learner. And so with the critiquing sections, his writing for the ear definitely improved. And by 1941, as I say in the book, there is evidence of of a script. One of the scripts that he wrote was for a series called Great Artists. And the Great Artists series aired on, I forget what station it aired, but it was a show that highlighted some of the artwork and or artists who produced work that was displayed in the Art Institute of Chicago. And so that 1941 piece was about Francisco Goya, the famous painter. And he really looked at, in his 15-minute script, why Goya produced and painted his anti-war paintings that he's known for. So even then, he was talking about issues of equality and freedom and injustice and the horrors of war and why are we doing this and what are the inequalities that brought about the need for that kind of war. So that was it.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, he continues to write. He's, you know, for a good period of time, he's kind of living that freelance life and writing for, among other things, the Lone Ranger radio show.
Right.
And he's writing for the Chicago Defender, where he's mentored by Metz Lockhart. And it's interesting because you mentioned that World War II period, 44-45, which were boom years for the black press, gave him somewhat maybe not paradoxically, but gave him a lot of work as a freelance writer. He also starts writing for the Democracy USA program, and I wonder if you would just explain for the listeners what sort of program Democracy USA was and some of the constraints that Durham was under as a scriptwriter for it.
Okay, good question. Well, he was actually not a freelancer for the Defender. He was actually a staff writer. Was working for them full time. But the Defender decided in the mid-40s that it wanted to try its hand at sponsoring a radio show because they saw it as another way of selling papers. That, you know, on the air, on the radio, they could have this wonderful dramatic series and promote the paper. So, of course, the Defender knew that Durham was a scriptwriter. Robert Lucas, his buddy from the Illinois Writers Project, also did some writing for the Defender. So they figured, oh, wow, we have two experienced scriptwriters and we can really make this show go. And what it was designed to be was a program, a weekly program that looked at African-American primarily, but, you know, there were some non-black people, focuses on folks who in their life and in their accomplishments typified the principles of democracy and freedom. So he was able to become, oh, he was hired as the main scriptwriter for that, along with Robert Lucas and I guess some others. But right when, right as the series was about to start, he got fired. And unfortunately, this kind of happened several times in his life, just to kind of show you this man's conviction and his kind of radical bent. And he was fired because he was pushing for the Chicago Defender to be part of the newspaper union, I think it's called the American Newspaper Guild. And of course, the Defender kind of resisted that push. But the whole point was not just to be a member of this union. It was so that the workers, the writers who worked on the paper could get equal pay, their hours would be, you know, really kind of, they would have more say in the assignments and the kind of work that they had to do and the kind of compensation that they would be able to receive. So he was fired. He went back into freelancing and Democracy USA went ahead and they quickly realized, oh, wait a minute. Maybe we really do need Richard Durham to work with us because this is no joke. I'm trying to do a weekly 15-minute dramatic program and do it with people who really know what they're doing. So he was hired back in 1946, and he was able to then work on that. So it was really it set up for Richard Durham what would later come and what would be his major claim to fame, and that was Destination Freedom. But that's how Democracy USA came about, and he really almost didn't get a chance to work on it because of his union moves.
Well, and before we actually get into Destination Freedom, I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about his wife, Clarice, whom was sort of the sort of main breadwinner for a lot of their marriage. She held a very had a very stable career, and his was a little more uncertain. With time, you know, things like you just mentioned, periods where he would be freelancing and not have staff positions. I wonder if you sort of talk about that a bit.
Well, Clarice Durham was actually the younger sister of a good friend of his, another writer named Robert Davis. And Robert Davis was also part of the Illinois Writers Project. So they met not at the IWP, but they met in a writing group back in the late 30s. And they were friends, and they remained friends throughout. One day, Durham went to the offices of the National Negro Congress, which was based in Chicago. It's a civil rights organization. And Robert had brought his sister with him because he had told her about this organization. And she said, oh, it sounds interesting. Let me go and check it out. And she went, and Durham was there. And Robert introduced Durham to Richard. And he was just smitten by this little pretty petite woman. And they went out on dates and eventually married about a year later. So she was there, and she was really a supportive spouse, working herself with the Illinois Compensation Office, but she had designs and plans of being a teacher. So eventually she went back to school and then became a kindergarten and preschool teacher. But she was, in a lot of ways, the stabilizing force in their marriage, and also a force or a point of some contention for Richard, because he was often searching for that next job or that next writing job. And one thing I will say, which was fairly unique at that time, is that Richard Durham made his living as a writer. He never worked in any other capacity. At one point, he thought he would have to, particularly during the war. But he just said, no, this is my path. This is what I want to do, and I'm going to find a way to do it. And so in a lot of ways, he did do that. But there were times when he was only paid per script. So, you know, if he was paid $100 a script or $110 or $120, whatever it was, that can be a little frustrating if you're not sure if, one, the script is going to come to you, if you're going to get the assignments. And then, you know, how do you know how much longer that this scenario is going to last? But so anyway, Clarice Durham was definitely in his supporter, his love, and they had some rocky times in their marriage early on, but she was right behind him and really, you know, helped to kind of keep the family together at times when his freelance work was a little spotty.
Thanks for sharing that. I just found that relationship and dynamic a really interesting part of the book. So Durham continues writing for Democracy Today, or I'm sorry, Democracy USA. But he also starts writing Destination Freedom, which in sort of an interesting full circle moment would air on the same station as Amos and Andy. And it was, you write in the book, conceived as a series of half hour dramas about the lives and contributions of prominent Negro history makers. So I wonder if you would sort of talk, just about Destination Freedom, what it was trying to do. Please.
Okay. No problem. Destination Freedom really was an outgrowth, an expansion of what Durham did with Democracy USA. And I will say, you did ask something about the restrictions. Democracy USA aired on WBBM, which was a CBS affiliate station in Chicago. So one of the things that the officials were not afraid of, but kind of told Durham that he needed to watch, and that was, you know, how he couldn't be but so radical or be but so vocal about some of the forms of discrimination and the fight against it from some of the people he featured. And he felt that was kind of like tying his hand behind his back in some ways. But he found, you know, small ways to get around it. You know, it might have been a section where a character said something about inequality or injustice, or there might have been a scenario that he dramatized that would demonstrate that. But with when Democracy USA went off the air, and I couldn't find exactly when, but it probably was in the early 1948 or late 1947, he was searching for his next major project. And in talking with friends, who included, by the way, Oscar Brown Jr., the singer-entertainer who, you know, was radical in his own way and really a fine entertainer and artist. And they sat down and said, okay, what if we propose to have a half hour, not a 15-minute short program, but a half an hour weekly drama series that highlights the accomplishments of some major historic and contemporary Black leaders, Negro leaders. And he proposed the idea to the Chicago Defender. They weren't as excited about trying to sponsor another show because they had some fallout that they had from WBBM, and they weren't really excited about going into radio again. But he worked his magic and talked with some NBC officials for the NBC affiliate station WMAQ in Chicago. And they worked out the details, and basically they said, okay, we'll give you the go-ahead to come up with this half an hour weekly show on WMAQ starting in June of 1948. And that's how Destination Freedom came about. Durham was the sole writer. He was a creator. He had come up with the title with some of his friends, and they based it on the spiritual Old Freedom. So that's kind of where the title came from. But he wanted to focus on people like from slavery. Let's talk about like Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass and Denmark Vesey, all the way to contemporary artists with people who had just made major history in terms of breaking down the color barrier. You know, folks like Jackie Robinson and Lena Horne and others in both entertainment, in education, in medicine, and you name it. So that's how Destination Freedom came about. And again, like I said, there were very little documents that really indicated how he convinced both the Chicago Defender and WMAQ to say, okay, we'll do this. But they worked out a deal, and it was going to be a joint sponsored program between the Chicago Defender and WMAQ and NBC. And it went on the air with the first show being about Crispus Attucks, the first black man to really kind of die in the service of the American Revolutionary War. And so they loved the first show, but Durham was late on getting the script accomplished. Now here, let me back up just a little bit. Richard Durham becomes the sole scriptwriter for this ongoing series. At the time, there wasn't any plan to say, okay, it's only going to run for a month or a week or whatever. But it was going to be an ongoing series, weekly, every Sunday morning at 10. And he was the writer for this half an hour show. It's hard enough to write 15 minutes or half an hour once a week or once a month. But if you're talking about not only doing the research, figuring out how you're going to dramatize whatever segment of this person's life is, and then actually getting into the studio and bringing the actors in and the technicians and the directors and all and making it happen, this was a phenomenal kind of feat. But he decided he wanted to do it. And his main thing was he wanted his voice, his vision, his signature writing to be what Destination Freedom was all about. Unfortunately, because he missed the first deadline, it was delayed. The debut of the show was delayed a week. Then NBC officials said, okay, we're going to have to bring in some other people. And get some other writers in here because we can't have this. We can't, you know, you can't miss a deadline for a live show that's going on the air at a certain time. We can't just put anything in its place if it doesn't happen. And Durham went crazy. He's like, wait a minute, hold up. This is my show and my vision and my copyright. And you can't just bring in other writers to do this. There was also an issue about Richard Durham getting paid the fee that he was supposed to get paid per script. And by the time this decision was made, he hadn't, I think it had been like 3 weeks into the series and he hadn't received the check. So he sat down, wrote this long, pretty eloquent letter and said, you need to cease and desist and here's why. And they worked it out and he became, once again, the sole writer for Destination Freedom.
The show is basically about blacks fighting white supremacy and what you describe in the book as a sort of racially inclusive universalism. And one of the interesting things about that is that it could only be heard in Chicago and not in the South. So I wonder if you talk about that as well as the sort of abrupt end that the show comes to for political reasons.
Yeah. Richard really wanted his program to, well, there were several things that were happening on several levels. He was essentially a freelance contractor while he worked on this show. He was never officially hired by WMAQ. He was not a staff member. And so he was paid on a script by script basis. But he, you know, the series was long running. It ran for 2 years. And he really wanted to expand the reach of the program and its message outside of Chicago and outside of the Chicago metropolitan area to the country, if not larger, but at least have it enjoy national distribution. The director of the series was a man named Homer Heck. He was a full-time employee of WMAQ, and he was the director. And he said, well, you know, I really don't see that happening. And given the tenor of the time still in 1948, 1949, and 50, if the show had received national distribution on the NBC network, it was clear that even then, the Southern affiliates would not play it, and there would be protests, and you know, there might be a fallout of you know, the show being canceled overall. So there was that tension between, okay, well, you know, yes, we're glad that this show is on the air and it's getting great reception in Chicago, but we think that based on the reception we are getting in Chicago, that it could be broadcast nationally and get the same kind of people who are just as interested in it across the country. I'll also say that after it had run about a year, it started winning a lot of awards, local awards, some national awards. And so to Durham, it was clear this could have life outside of the Chicago area. NBC, of course, resisted it. And as the show went on, the tensions kind of escalated. And finally, in 1950, Durham started looking at options of, well, okay, there's this thing called television coming in. And television, it was clear, was going to be the next hot new mass medium. So while maybe I could try to find a way to get Destination Freedom on the national radio network, I'd have even more eyeballs and potential for outreach if it was on television. And so he starts to think about that and the tensions that he had with NBC officials and WMAQ escalated to a point where he finally said in August of 1950, I'm done, we're over. The problem, though, was that he had started negotiating with some potential funders to back his idea to either go to television or national radio. And just as he was doing this, and it looked like it was going to work, he had found some folks who he'd worked with previously who said, yes, we're interested in working with you. Let's see what we can do. WMAQ... in October of that year, this is 1950, announced that the reemergence of this wonderful award-winning show was going to start airing in late October. And this wonderful new show was called Destination Freedom. Not only that, but while Destination Freedom in Durham's world was about these African-American heroes and heroines and innovators and really wonderful people who were doing great things. With the new iteration of this Destination Freedom from WMAQ, it was all about white heroes. And so when he heard this and saw the advertisements, and they didn't consult him about this at all, he quickly called them up and said, oh, you have to cease and desist. This is my work and this is my copyright. You can't just appropriate it this way. And of course, they claimed that he was a staff writer and this was their, they owned it. Long story short, he decided to sue. And I tell folks is that if you think about it, in 1950, for this lone black man to sue a major network, was, I'm sure that WMAQ and NBC thought, who is this guy? What does he think he's going to do? But he decided to go ahead and sue, and it wound its way through the court. But that's why there was this abrupt end, and then it came back on air for a short period of time as this show about white heroes.
Yeah, and after, perhaps concurrent with this protracted legal wrangling that followed his suit, he starts working with the UPWA, the United Packing House Workers of America, a progressive union. He wrote for UWPA, UPWA Publications, which in turn sort of opens the way for some involvement, significant involvement rather, with the Nation of Islam. And I wonder if you would sort of talk about that that transition.
Yeah, in the book, I talk about how once he sued WMAQ and NBC, clearly he was a person non grata in the broadcast industry. He could not work in radio, and he also couldn't get into television, which is where he saw himself moving. So he had to find other work. And the other work that he found initially was as a contractor for the United Packing House Workers of America. And he wrote, he was hired to write a pamphlet about workers' rights and that. That contract ended up becoming a full-time position, and he ended up becoming a really major power broker within the union, helping to work on the education programs that the UPWA initiated and some of the social justice initiatives that they created and really recommended that their union members participate in. It was really an invigorating kind of time for him, because now we're talking about the early to mid 1950s, and the civil rights movement, as we call it now, was really taking off. And he had a chance to interact with a range of people. I write about how he got involved or helped his members get involved with the Emmett Till case, the case of the 14-year-old Chicago youth who went to Mississippi in the summer of 1955 and was killed horribly by the relatives of a woman who supposedly this young boy had whistled at. And so they got involved with that. Durham helped to kind of finagle some things there. And then he also was involved or got involved with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. When King came to Chicago to raise money to support the Montgomery bus boycott. So he had his hands in really a little bit of everything. And he was writing and organizing and educating. He was really kind of taking his activist writing role to another level. It wasn't a media, it wasn't radio, and it wasn't television, but it was related, and it really kind of used all of his skills because he was a master organizer, and he also knew how to read people and understand what helped to motivate folks. So that's what he did. But again, with his forward thinking and his sometimes being a bit too forward, he got fired in 1957 from the union, which I detail in the book. And then he moved on eventually to becoming the editor of Muhammad Speaks, which was the national newspaper of the Nation of Islam. Now, one of the things that really happened, I had an opportunity to interview his brothers and sisters who were still alive when I started the project. And they said, well, the Nation of Islam, you're not Muslim. What are you doing? But the thing that I learned, and it's just really a wonderful exploration of the way this man thought and how he figured different ways to reach audiences, and primarily African-American, but he was really interested in various audiences and different ways you could reach them and provide information and inspire them to positive social change. And that's what he saw as the opportunity in Muhammad Speaks. It was a newspaper that, of course, talked about what's happening in the nation in this religious organization. But it was also a newspaper that clearly was about covering news that affected Black people in the diaspora, in the African diaspora, and around the world. So what is happening in Asia? What is going on in South Africa or other parts of Africa? What is going on in Europe that also affects what's happening in America? What is happening across the American landscape? So he saw this as a way of reaching not only a range of people, but also talking about issues in ways that you might not find in, say, the New York Times or the Washington Post. So that's how he gravitated to the Nation of Islam's paper, and he was, as several people told me in the interviews that I did, he was the best writer and the most inspiring writer on the paper. He led by example. So if you were assigned to write a piece and you'd go off and you'd write it and bring it back in and he would read it, you know, and say thank you and move on. And then you might find that once it was published in the paper, he had rewritten it to just be a whole nother kind of thing. Not that it took away from the essence of what you did, but he made it even better and more compelling. And that was his whole thing too, that you write and you write about things you may know, or if you don't know it, you do enough research so that you feel comfortable in writing about it, and then you can infuse all of the elements that you can bring to it. Your knowledge, even if it's recently acquired knowledge, what the analysis of that knowledge, you know, means in terms of the interpretation of the event or whatever, and then moving on from there. So he established, which was also fairly unique, a really great relationship with Elijah Muhammad, who was the head of the Nation of Islam, and was able to convince Mr. Muhammad that the news of the world, the news about Black people and people of color in the world, should be separate from the news that is about the nation. Similar to, as someone told me, similar to what happened with, if you read the Christian Science Monitor. So the Christian Science Monitor is really known as a newspaper that has some great, excellent news coverage, but it also has maybe sections that deal with, you know, specifically religious subjects. So that's kind of the model that Durham used or followed while he was the editor of Mom Speaks.
So another key part of that period of his life is the other Muhammad, right? Muhammad Ali, with whom he would also develop a professional relationship. But his television writing career finally begins. So I wonder if you would talk about both of those things.
In the book, I talk about how television had fascinated him from the late 40s. So television was a medium that he clearly saw himself gravitating towards. But with the lawsuit against NBC, you know, that was put on hold. Once the lawsuit reached its conclusion, which I talk about in the book, he then was able to do some things, although his name was not necessarily attached to it. And both his relatives and some friends speculated that it may have been because if you're talking about the 50s, kind of leading into the 60s, you still had some remnants of the blacklist, people who were blacklisted because if they were communists or leftists, and you know what that meant, but also because you know he had become a person non grata with his lawsuit. But he was able to do some freelance writing for various shows, science fiction programs, like The Outer Limits, for those people who may remember that, and Climax, and some others. And so he did that. And then in the late 1960s, there came an opportunity to work on a show that WTTW, which is the public broadcasting affiliate in Chicago, had projected to initiate in Chicago in 1970. And it was really going to be a serial program about Black life in Chicago. He was hired as the head writer. It was a staff of writers. And if you know anything about television writers, most of the time, you know, there cannot be one person who writes each weekly show. So there is a group of writers or staff, a set of staff writers who work on a series and produce the scripts that are then dramatized. And so Durham was hired as the head writer. The show became known as Bird of the Iron Feather. And in the book, I talk about how he came to that title. It was really inspired by Frederick Douglass. And then he decides that his protagonist is going to be a Black police officer, a Black detective. Well, if you know anything about Chicago, both in the 60s and later, the Chicago Police Department has a storied past, and that story is not always positive, particularly if you're talking about the African-American community. So his idea was to look at family life and conditions in Chicago among people, Black folks in that city, using this protagonist, this Black police officer, and his family and his associates, including his fellow police officers. And so that's what Bird of the Iron Feather was about. Initially, the station, WTTW, received the Ford Foundation grant to get this show off the ground. And the plan was to have 100 episodes that would last for 6 months on a 5-day-a-week schedule, half an hour shows. But as I detail in Word Warrior, the thing that happened was once the Black community heard about this forthcoming show series, they really got excited and bought into it, but they also wanted things done. You know, they didn't want an Amos and Andy on television with Black people. They wanted something really positive. And of course, the definitions of positive varied. So there was all this consternation and activism and organizing and protests that went on behind the scenes that really kind of transformed what the series became. And once it went on the air in January of 1970, given all of the background, that turmoil that really got it to that point, it eventually became the number one viewed show at that point on WTTW. But also, because of the turmoil, it only lasted 21 episodes, which is kind of amazing. If you think, oh, they had projected 100, then they kind of said, okay, 100 might be too ambitious, so let's then go to 36, and that 36 actually became 21. So in the book, I talk about how that evolved, and really it was a victim, but also representative of the times, because even though there were more Black people on screen during the 1960s, there weren't as many behind the scenes. And that was part of the struggle.
As I mentioned, the period that I covered from the second to last chapter of the book, actually, talk about both of them. Chapters 11 and 12 in the book are devoted to world travels with Muhammad Ali, and then later his work with Harold Washington, who becomes the first Black mayor of Chicago. And I wonder if you would talk about his relationships and the way he supported the careers of those two sort of titans.
Talking about Muhammad Ali and Harold Washington, those were some of the hardest chapters to write. Not because there was not a wealth of material, there was, but both Harold and Ali are such big figures. You know, Harold Washington, maybe not as much on a national scale, but Ali, Muhammad Ali, definitely. And so in writing that and doing the research on Durham's role in that whole creation of the book that is now called The Greatest, My Own Story, was really, really difficult. But it was really also wonderful to find out the role that Durham played in the initial negotiation of getting the book contract. Once the contract with Random House was solidified, and then he started working with Ali, some of the struggles that he had in working with Muhammad Ali. And the whole idea that when they went into the project, Ali was essentially banned from fighting because of his refusal to be inducted into the army. So he was essentially a champion in exile. And I think initially the book was going to look at, you know, this international figure in exile and how he, you know, moved on from that. When it became clear by the early 70s that, you know, he might get a chance to fight again and it might happen sooner than later, then the focus had to be, okay, so the exile thing happened and now he might fight again. And what does that mean in terms of Ali and the championship? And maybe the book can end with him regaining his title. So that was really kind of the way Ali and Durham approached it. And unfortunately for Random House, they saw this as something that could be a quick turnaround kind of book. And they also saw that given his notoriety as well as his popularity, that the book would be, well, they hoped, of course, that it would be a bestseller. Wherever Ali was in the process. But as it turned out, it took a lot longer than they thought. So while the contract may have happened in 1970, the book didn't come out till 1975. And the whole time, the press was, hey, what are you guys doing? We need to have this book. Luckily, for both Muhammad Ali as well as for Durham, they had a editor who was in their corner and supportive and also someone who could press them or press Durham, since he was the actual writer, to really get this done. And that was Toni Morrison. Toni Morrison, at that point, was a senior editor at Random House, and she inherited this assignment to work on with Durham on The Greatest. And the thing that she said, I had the wonderful opportunity to interview her about her relationship with Durham during this period, and she said, one, he was a great writer. She learned a lot from him. He was dynamic. They had a great relationship. And she also had a good relationship with Ali himself. But she would press him. Her bosses would press her. And Durham just, he was turning out the chapters that he turned out, but it was just really slow. And the thing that happened was, she recognized that everything he turned in was so good that, you know, to try to find another writer, Ali, first of all, would have objected, but to find another writer who was going to be as good as Dora was probably not going to happen, and that they just needed to keep pushing him and pushing Ali to get it done. The book was actually published in 1975, and 2 years later, The Greatest, the film, based on the book, was released. Durham did not write the script, although I think at one point he may have been approached about that, but he didn't write the script and he wasn't happy with the way the book was interpreted. But yes, it was really a whirlwind time for him, traveling with Ali, making sure that he was at every of the, every one of the fights that Ali had during the period once he started fighting again, and then following him around with his tape recorder, recording conversations. He said at one point that Ali actually talked in his sleep, and he would talk in lucid sentences. So he would record that and, you know, and get that and try to figure out ways to incorporate it into the book. But yeah, so that was the Ali time. And then once he finished, excuse me, working on the book, he did some freelancing, but he also ghost wrote another book. It's the autobiography by Anthony Quinn, the Mexican-American actor. His name is not attached to it, but he was the ghostwriter of that book. And he had other projects and other business deals that he was working. And then in the 70s, he reunited with his good friend, Harold Washington. Harold and Richard Durham became friends in the 40s when Harold was still a student at Roosevelt University in Chicago. And, you know, I'm sure that they kept in touch over the years. But when Harold ran for mayor the first time, he ran in 1977, he was unsuccessful. But he energized, you know, quite a few people, said, you know, this man has something going on here, and maybe down the road. So in 1982, with the next mayoral campaign, and once Harold Washington decided he was going to run again, several of the folks around him, his campaign managers and organizers, were like, well, you need someone who's going to help you frame your press message. And again, this is not because Harold Washington wasn't articulate and couldn't do it himself, but, you know, he was running a campaign and he couldn't do it by himself and he couldn't do everything. So everybody looked in this one organizational meeting and said, yep, you need someone to help you. And we know just who, Richard Durham. And if you'll have him, I think it'll be great. And Richard was like, yeah. And Harold said, hey, let's do it. So every morning, just about, on the campaign trail, Harold Washington and his driver would go to Richard Durham's house, pick him up, and then they'd ride around to various campaign stops. Richard would advise Harold, and then he would, you know, go back and maybe, you know, write some speeches or campaign notes or notes about his position, Harold's position. And he was his man, his kind of second, I don't want to say second in command because he had several other folks around him, but he was a major player in the campaign through Harold's win in 1983. He decided, though, this is Richard, decided that he was not going to join the Harold Washington administration once he became mayor, but he was a trusted advisor and friend, continued to be, you know, friend who Harold would come over or go over to Richard and Clarice's house and sit and talk and, you know, get advice from Richard Durham on a regular basis. And so their friendship lasted until Richard died in 1984.
It really is a remarkable life, and I'm really glad that through your book, lots of people, myself included, are getting a chance to know more about him. I wonder if you'd tell us about any current projects you might have in the works, or anything else you might be working on.
Yeah, I have some plans in the work to maybe do, I think I mentioned in the beginning that music was my first love and still continues to be. And, you know, that I got into radio myself in terms of both announcing and producing and writing because of my love for radio. what I would like to do next, and have started kind of making moves in that direction, is to write about women, Black women musicians, and maybe look at their lives and contributions on a generational basis. So, maybe take some artists and really kind of examine their life, but look at it in terms of what were some of the challenges and successes that they experienced based on, you know, their coming of age in the music and in the business, and then how that contrasted or, you know, was the same for other artists who may have come later or earlier. So that's what I'm looking at and thinking about right now.
Well, that sounds like a really, really great project.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Well, Professor Williams, thank you so much for joining me today. I really have enjoyed it. I really enjoyed reading the book, as I mentioned, and it's been a real pleasure to speak with you about it.
It's been a pleasure talking about it. I never thought that this would captivate me, that Richard Durham's story would captivate me the way it has. But his life and his writing and his activism really touched me, and I'm just happy that I was able to in the book talk about his trajectory, and really talk about the fact that he used his voice, his word, to be a warrior, but his weapons were his words, and that, you know, it was all in the service of freedom, justice, and equality, and the whole idea that those principles should be universally applied and enjoyed by everyone.
Folks, you've been listening to the New Books in African American Studies podcast. We are joined today by Professor Sonia D. Williams, who is the author of Word Warrior, Richard Durham, Radio, and Freedom, published by the University of Illinois Press. Thanks so much. We hope you'll join us again soon.